Welcome to the Birth Activist Podcast with me, Becky Scott. These next few episodes, we'll be covering the March with Midwives campaign that's currently happening nationwide across the UK. We'll be looking at the reasons why the movement started and what actually is happening in the maternity services at the moment. How can we help and what are we trying to achieve from this campaign? I really hope you enjoy these episodes.
I'd just like to make a little apology for the sound quality on parts of this podcast. For some reason, my mic wasn't working particularly well. Hopefully, it won't take away from the podcast content, which is absolutely amazing. Enjoy.
Hi, and welcome to the Birth Activist Podcast. Today, we have another special episode. Today, we have three lovely midwives with us. We have Millie Morris, Marilla Krosky, and Elsie Gale with us. Hello, lovely ladies.
Hi, Becky.
Hi, Becky.
Thank you all for joining me this evening. And you're joining me because you're part of the steering group for the March with Midwives campaign. Those of you that have been extra good and been listening to the podcast that we recorded yesterday with myself, Maddie, Verena and Paula will know a bit more about the campaign. So this podcast is more about the viewpoint of the midwives involved. So first of all, if you wouldn't mind each just a little brief introduction as to who you are, can we start with Millie?
Hi, yeah, I'm Millie. I'm a midwife working outside the NHS at the moment, and I provide birth care via private midwives. And I got involved with March with Midwives right at the very beginning because some of my friends, well, a friend, she thought it up. She was like, let's do this thing. She planned it very locally. And we all went, do you know what? Actually, this is a national issue. Let's do it. So, yes, that's the basics.
Thanks, Millie. Marilla.
I'm a new midwife, relatively, and I'm an NHS midwife practicing in London. When I was a student midwife, I was quite traumatized by everything that I'd witnessed and been through, and almost quit midwifery. Took a year out, trained in psychotherapy, thinking I'll be working with midwives and parents, and thought, no, I'm going to come back. I'm going to do it. I'm going to be a midwife, but I'm going to come back fighting. So when Millie told me what was happening with the March with Midwives, I thought, we've got to get on that. That is exactly the fight. We've been waiting for this moment. So fantastic. jumped at the opportunity.
Thanks, Marilla. Elsie, you don't really need much of an introduction, but please do introduce yourself to the listeners.
I wonder why that is. Okay, so I'm Elsie. I am a midwife. I've been a midwife for a very long time, and I am in private practice. I do a 0 hours with private midwives because at the moment, this is the only way we can actually do births. Mm-hmm. But I also support my community, the Black community, particularly women who think they want a free birth for whatever reason. And involved with an organization I developed called Midwifery Conversations, which is doing a lot of work around aspiring midwives, helping them to understand what it is they're coming into before they take the leap, but also supporting midwives who have fallen foul of the system, whether they've been bullied, tried to commit suicide, you know, a lot of support in terms of midwives themselves. Yeah, so basically that's what I do. I love the profession. There is nothing quite like it. So, and by the way, I am a trained doula. that's hardly known, but I kind of did that because when I returned from traveling, I was really astonished at the lack of the hands-on care that was missing from midwifery practice. So I did that to gain that, you know, regain that, to be honest. So, yeah.
Fantastic. That's, yeah, definitely not something I knew. So hopefully that's something exclusive for the listeners. I know that Maddie and Developing Doulas, she's always offering places to student midwives and midwives to come and do the doula training, because like you say, it really does sort of bring you back to those basics of that nurturing, those listening skills and communication skills, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So, okay, so we're 3 weeks into the campaign, just about, sort of, and now we're all sort of pulling our pants because there's not much time left before the vigil. Who wants to start the conversation about, you know, why this is necessary? Why is it necessary that we are having to do these campaigns? Why is it necessary that we are having to, you know, take this drastic action?
So let me just start by saying that Maddie invited me to join the steering group. And to be honest, I didn't really need a lot of thinking whether I needed to join it, because the voice of the midwife has been totally absent from the crisis in maternity care. The crisis in maternity care has actually been going on for a very long time. And if you look back into the work of people like Mavis Kirkham, Sheena Byram, Helen Shallow, you know, we can see the undertones, but the voice of the midwife has been completely absent, really. And those of us who have stood up to say something's not right, we get hammered down, squashed down. And at the moment, I'm supporting a midwife who was made destitute because she dared to open her mouth. So the one thing that I do remember is Sheila Kitzinger saying, women will have to take back childbirth. And I think this for me, and in terms of the development of MVPs and the, you know, the MSLCs that preceded them, the importance of the user voice for me is most powerful. So I'm really happy to be a part of this, really.
We're really happy to have you, Elsie.
Thank you.
So, Marina, is that something that you experienced? You know, obviously, you talk about it if you want to, as a student midwife, that and raising concerns of what you were seeing. Was that, did you feel silenced at that time?
I feel like if things happened and people were asked to write statements, I was always not asked to write statements, even if I'd been a witness to things. I mean, you know, when you're a student and you're looking for mentors and you're hoping it's going to be someone that is going to be, I mean, an amazing midwife, all midwives are amazing, but someone that is confident to teach you and maybe is a little bit subversive to the system and will teach you the tricks and will teach you how to be a midwife, not how to be a nurse or how to be bullied or how to be told off for suggesting maybe spinning babies techniques or something else. No, we don't do that here. So that is a big... any thinking outside the box. So when you did find a mentor like that, you held on to them like gold dust. But it's that sort of feeling that, you know, when you come out of being a student and you're a midwife and you think, am I alone in thinking this? Mm-hmm. We've come into work and we're six midwives down and we all talk about, you know, the staffing crisis as a buzzword and everyone has the political conversations, but we come into work, we're six midwives down. Oh, okay, we'll just get on with it. No one's getting up and saying anything. And I don't know if it's part of the individualized culture that we're in, but it does make you feel by yourself. So this march for me, these vigils, at the very least, it's a massive mental health boost for everybody to realize they're not by themselves. And that's why I wanted to join. And it's important because it's solidarity. It shows you, you know, even if only 10 of us turn up on the day, that's 10 of us that were like, oh, you think this too. Oh my God, thank goodness. It's not just me.
There does seem to be an element of the whole working conditions and the way that midwives are working in the NHS at the moment as being normalised. That it's just the way it is and you just have to get on with it.
Yeah, I've got a little story from when I was still in the NHS. And I was really lucky. The placement that I had as a student had a pretty positive culture, actually, and there wasn't a lot of bullying, and there was really reasonably good communication, and I felt okay there were one or two anomalies. There always are, there's always people on the extremes, And you know, some of that was really hard to deal with, but it's more about the generalized culture. And this is where goodwill has taken safety so far. So midwives mostly come into the profession because they deeply want to do good. They want to do a good job. They want people to have a safe journey through to parenthood. And, you know, generally these are people who care about stuff. Mm. And because of that, it's really easy to take advantage of them.
Yes.
So yeah. I was not very well. I didn't know how ill I was, but I was heading into being very unwell. And we were at the beginning of a shift having a handover. And I was just writing, just after the handover, just writing my list of things that I needed to do so that I was straight, and I had a palpitation. And this palpitation went on. And I suddenly thought, I'm going to faint. So I lay down on the floor. Blacked out very briefly, came back to, thought, oh, right, good, that's over. And then thought, oh, my heart's really banging now and I don't feel very well. But I got up and I did my shift. Mm-hmm. And if anyone had come to me and said they'd had a palpitation that bad, I'd have said, you go down to A&E now, get your blood pressure checked, there's something up.
Yeah.
But we didn't. We pulled together, we finished, we did our shift. We looked after the people that we'd come in to look after. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, now I look back at that and I'm just like, what was I doing? Why wasn't I looking after myself? But that's what the culture is. That's how it is. It's, we're there to serve. Some people kind of have an interesting angle on that, but that's how I felt. And we just do it. And so the system, which has many flaws for the people within it, so the service users and the staff, the system works very well for itself. It's just abuses everyone within it, and it's held up, it's propped up by that goodwill, superwoman energy, and that's what's running out. And there's a combination of factors,
and some people will listen to that, Millie, and think that, well, that's because of the pandemic, because, you know, we're having to pull together, and these things have happened because of the pandemic. And a lot of people will listen to that and think that sounds familiar, because that was happening, but it was in the pandemic and that's the cause of it.
But the pandemic has kicked the feet out from under people who were already on their knees, already giving everything, and not having flexible working time.
And your story already, was well before the pandemic.
Yeah, it was well before the pandemic, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and So it's, the pandemic has, it's sharpened the urgency. And the thing that really angers me is that the stock response from government and from MPs is, we're making it easier for people to train, we're going to get more students. It's utterly irrelevant when the majority of students do not stay in the profession. It doesn't matter how many students you get. And yes, there are problems I think it's a huge mistake removing the bursary, because there's usually a very broad intake from society of people who want to be midwives. And we need that broadness, because we've got all sorts of people seeking our services within the NHS. Yeah. So you need all sorts of people to provide care as midwives for all sorts of people. But when the bursary was taken away, it took away that option for people who maybe needed to retrain or already had families, or were older, because they don't have the capacity to take on the debt.
Yeah.
But then coming in now and saying, oh, we're going to make it easier for students. I'm sorry, I'm controlling my potty mouth.
Let that potty mouth go. It's fine.
The problem is that students are leaving because the conditions are unmanageable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so unless we have a massive shake-up of what's going on and massive increase, we've been short around 3,000 midwives for years. And this isn't that there aren't enough midwives, it's that not enough midwives are being employed by the CCGs.
It's that usual tactic of sticking a plaster over something and not actually going to the root of the problem, isn't it?
So we've been, because I still feel very much connected to the to my NHS siblings. We're midwives. We provide an there's nothing like it. And we work together. We're supporting the autonomous, informed decision making of usually well people going through a normal process of life.
Yeah.
And so we are all connected because that's what we're all here for. But that shortage is because they're not being employed. It's not because they're not there. It's because the shifts are being cut back to as few as possible, just in case it's a Q word, a quiet shift.
Yes.
Can't have midwives sitting around doing nothing. So we'll have the minimum amount of midwives we can get away with. And not counting babies. So not counting babies in the number of patients is a really good way of getting away with far fewer midwives.
Oh, yes. I didn't even realise that happened until recently. That was a new one on me. I was like, you're kidding. You know, because for every woman or birthing person that midwife is looking after, there's another person there that's just been born that needs looking after as well. So, yeah, it's baffling, isn't it?
Yeah. The thing is, though, you know, Millie, I've been a midwife for a number of years, and there has been a shortage for a very long time, which is not necessarily connected, I think. I mean, this is my opinion, not necessarily connected to the CCG situation, because this was in the time of the PCTs in particular. And the government has realized that there has been a shortage for many, many years, because I recall there was a project set up in Bedfordshire, in a Bedfordshire trust, to actually recruit, to look into the situation for midwives and then to recruit and retain midwives, because that's part of the problem as well, the retention.
Yeah.
So some of the work I was doing was trying to ensure that student midwives would not leave. Once they got this precious space at university, they wouldn't leave the placement, because there's no way on God's earth they could be replaced. So there was an attrition rate of 1/3 of student midwives, which could never be replaced because they were already started the course and the course had, you know, it was going on. So there was that. But then people who qualified but then didn't practice. Mm. And then the older experienced midwives who would nurture the incoming midwives, they were just walking out because we could leave at age 55. We could retire at age 55. Many people retired and went on to do something else. Some people, I mean, this is well described by Mavis Kirkham in her work for the Royal College of Midwives. Many midwives then tried to find niche jobs where they could be autonomous in that role rather than sort of be hammered and chewed up in the system. Mm. And then we had the development of the human resources part of trust, which, you know, we then became widgets in a system. So, you know, it's just ridiculous. I think the people who have the power don't understand what it is we do.
Yeah.
And we get crushed because, to be honest, I'm very disappointed with our trade unions.
Yes.
Mm. Very disappointed. And many, many midwives now belong to nothing, which is really very sad, because we need something to help us, whether it is in terms of our updating, whether it's in terms of being supported when we have issues at work and so on. But I think our leadership can be very poor, which is not helpful. And what I've seen, certainly working through the pandemic, there is good leadership out there, good clinical leadership, good management. And where that exists, the service is fantastic, you know, despite all the problems, because people put their best foot forward. And some of those heads of midwifery in particular have been recruiting non-employed midwives. They've been recruiting those midwives to support their service. So I don't know what the solution is, to be honest, but we have to do something. And the culture and the climate in which midwives are working is unsustainable.
Absolutely unsustainable.
Elsie, I just want to pick up on a point that you mentioned there about the trade unions. I'm literally having a conversation earlier today saying, you know, when I think of trade unions, I think back to my childhood in the 80s, and I think of pickets and people walking out and disruption to services and angry people trying to make change. And often there was change from those actions. But, you know, even when we're trying to, you know, take action, which is what March with Midwives is about, there are so many restrictions at the minute. You know, we've been told that we can't actually march because otherwise we'd need to tell the police and then the police could disband us like immediately. We've been told we can't call it a protest because that's too much like industrial action, that people can't leave their posts, which obviously we, you know, we would never ask a midwife to leave their post. So many restrictions there. You know, the RCM and the NMC have both come in and not sort of said, yes, we're supporting our members. They've not said that. What they've said is, well, we can't stop you from going, but if you, you know, don't follow the code, or if you don't follow these rules, then you know, there might be consequences. So none of them are saying, we're behind you, we want this action, you know. I mean, how does that make you all feel as midwives?
Well, I think, certainly from my perspective, I know that that would be their take. I know that because, to be honest, the Royal College of Midwives, to me, are a very conservative trade union. They're more of a professional organization, in my view, than a proper out and out trade union, you know, march, let's picket and so on. And you only have to look at the pay, how they've managed the pay review. So we as midwives have been moved towards the, I think it's 2.5% or 3%, I'm not sure because I'm not actually in the NHS and paying too much attention to that. Having said that, the Royal College of Nursing, they are now doing an indicative ballot to see whether people are going, they're going for the 12.5%. You know, there's no holding back on that. So they're in the difference between the two, really. So, yeah.
The response wasn't something that you weren't expecting.
No, not at all. I mean, I expected that would be the case because they're more into negotiation, working things out at the level, you know, but it is very important for us to follow the code. I mean, the breach of code, that is it. Yeah. So there are ways of, so we in our neck of the woods, we are vigiling, nothing wrong with that. And this is what we're doing. And we're ticking all the boxes. We've done all the risk assessments. We've spoken to all the relevant people. So we are following all the rules, but we are also making a statement that something is wrong and something needs to be done.
Yeah. And I think that was the point of the campaign. It was to make it possible for people to have a voice and to take action safely and within the rules so that no one could turn around and say, sorry, you've broken the rules, so stop doing what you're doing. But having said that, as part of the steering group, we've heard of people still being told by their management that they can't go, or that they shouldn't go, or that they may have consequences if they go, haven't we?
Well, they're in the culture, you know, it's just demonstrating the culture, one of.
It shows how vulnerable, in a way, some of the heads of midwifery and other leaders are feeling themselves. And then, and picking up on something that Elsie said, there are places where there are heads of midwifery, where there is a positive culture, where there are amazing things happen. And we've got to cling on to that. And I think but in a way, I think, you know, it shouldn't be reliant on individuals. The whole system should be set up to support those positive cultures. And also recognizing that when you've got management who don't feel empowered, anyone under them isn't going to feel empowered either, because empowered midwives empower people. And if you've got bullying coming down from the top, who's at the bottom?
Yeah.
The service user.
Yeah.
And we know that people who hurt sometimes hurt others.
Yeah.
And people who are not feeling empowered in their role, they don't have any autonomy. No one ever listens to the fact that they're having a really hard time finding childcare, or you know, that they could just, please, can they just have a regular shift pattern, please? Because it would make life so much easier for everyone in their family. Why can that not be done? Just because someone's not prepared to put in the tiny little bit of extra work to fiddle with the rotors or make it, and they're worried that everyone's going to ask for the same hours and the same shifts, and it becomes overwhelming. And because they're not well supported from above, they don't feel able to go, hang on a minute, maybe we could do something about this. And this would improve morale, and it would reduce sickness, and it would increase retention, you know, the knock on. So it's like,
and I guess the higher up the chain they are, the more they've got to lose, really.
Yeah. And people want to keep their position. People are desperate. You know, this is one of the reasons why we haven't had a revolution in this country. Yeah. It's because people want to be able to pay their mortgage, and they want to be able to pay their car loan, and they want to be able to have that holiday, and they want to be able to put this money away for their kids, and risking any of that is unthinkable. They don't. A lot of people don't.
I just want to ask Marilla, do you see this as well, Marilla, in your, you know, as a starting out midwife?
Are you there, Marilla?
Yeah, I'm here. Do I see the
what we're saying, what we're talking about, you know, that as older midwives in the system sort of thing, you know, do you feel like that as well, you know, just starting out?
I feel like the powerlessness is palpable, and that's intended to be that way. The decisions aren't made by you. You don't have anything to do with the guidelines. You don't have anything to do with how it's run and how the policy is run, how it's written and what we're going to do. The people above you have that, and they have to do what the people above them are told, and then they have to do what the people above them are told. And it's always this mysterious managerial they that is telling you what to do. And to go to switch that
autonomy, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly what it is. And so when I heard about this vigil, as it has become, I thought, I absolutely have to go there. And I was so shocked and disappointed to hear what the unions were not saying at first. It took a long time for them to make any kind of statement to say, it's okay, go ahead, do it, just stay within the code. But it's that the reversal of the chain going from up to down is, you know, we're constantly saying to women, of course you're allowed. Am I allowed is the question. And we're always saying, of course you're allowed. It is, you have rights, you're allowed. But if the midwives are saying, am I allowed? Mm. Am I allowed to go to this march? Am I the vigil? Am I allowed to join women and birthing parents and doulas in a vigil who they've started it? Am I allowed to go there and just stand with them and say, I'm here? If we're asking that, then are we able to say to the people we're looking after, yes, you're allowed. And I believe that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Very, very powerful words there. It is about mirroring, isn't it? It's that, you know, if I'm, as a midwife, I'm not allowed to do something, I'm being told I'm not allowed, then how can I actually exert that onto the people I'm working with to be able to tell them that they're allowed? I guess that's why there are still a lot of midwives that do pull the old you're not allowed line out of the bag every now and again. So I imagine that that's probably obviously what they're hearing all the time.
That's where they feel safe. Because outside of that doesn't feel safe. And that's one of the things that's so liberating. Well, I was a doula before I became a midwife, and I should have known better. And I did know better because I'd seen what it's like, and I'd seen how hard it was for midwives to support bodily autonomy.
Yeah.
And I'd seen that there were midwives who don't actually have no concept of doing that, bless them, you know, and that was like, whoa. And I trained with some people who were like that. When my absolute reason for being a midwife is to support informed decision making and the bodily autonomy of the people that I'm supporting, all I want is for them to be fit to parent when they come through the birth process. And to have the resources to understand, to be able to ask questions, to explore, to make the right decisions for them. And And yet coming through the training, I knew I was going to find it hard, but I had to shut my mouth and watch things be done so that I could qualify. So things be done to people, people be manipulated into doing things, of coercion. And that's really, it was really shocking, but I'd seen it, it's kind of expected. And I hoped, and I met other midwives who also hoped that they could change the system from within. You know, every person that we meet, that we are able to support, even in tiny, tiny ways, their autonomy over their own bodies, it makes a big difference. It's not about whether you had a good birth or a bad birth. It's whether you were able to make decisions, whether you understood what was happening. Then you recover well. It doesn't matter if it's like the craziest, scariest thing ever. If you made the decisions and you understood what was happening, then you're a better chance of recovering well. You can have what all the midwives would say, oh, that was a normal birth, and you can be traumatized because you didn't feel safe and you didn't feel heard and you didn't feel listened to. So I think I've lost my point. But
do you think that the reason that so many midwives come out of training, because you all have, you know, virtually the same training, and into a system where they're seeing these things, which it goes against everything that they've been taught and the way they want to practice as a midwife, that there's an element of self-preservation in just accepting and doing as you're told. Do you think?
Yeah.
I think, I mean, what a midwife is, I didn't get training in how to be a lawyer in my training. I didn't get training in how to be a statistician or a printer tech or an IT techie or a therapist or a copywriter of all the notes I have to write. There's so much than a midwife does, I don't think people understand the entirety of the role. And you can spend your whole day doing all these other jobs and you barely look the person you're looking after in the eye. So I felt quite overwhelmed. It was overwhelmed. And so I can imagine how, you know, if you've just been thrown into this and you've got two women to look after and the ratio should be 1-to-1, and you're being told to do this, to have even that energy to think, okay, I don't think this is right. I can't do this. I'm going to fight it. I'm going to fight this. I'm exhausted. I've done, you know, more hours than I should have this week. My kids are, I haven't seen them for hours, for days. You know, it's so hard to find that energy in a system that is just designed to make you feel like, no.
But the thing I think is we've allowed this as a profession. We have allowed this to happen. And I don't know. I could never work like that. You know, I've been in, before the pandemic, certainly been in with clients, supporting them. And I am the midwife as far as I'm concerned, because the midwife has just been sitting at the computer looking at the CTG and then to the computer, I just like, what is this? She's never palpated her, not all the time, right? But she's never palpated her contraction. She hasn't spoken to the woman, and it's just crazy. But then this one Christmas time, a couple of years ago, I was totally blown away by this young, newly qualified midwife who was doing her computer, but guess what? She was doing everything else, absolutely everything else. So, you know, even in the darkest days of midwifery practice, there are some very bright sparks out there. And that gives me hope to know that there are young women out there, young men out there, people are coming forward to actually maintain good midwifery practice, good woman-centered, person-centered care. And we need to keep that going.
I do remember, just remembering back to a couple of my own births, and I vividly remember the student midwives, because they were the ones that were actually able to give me the time, whilst the actual midwife was having to do notes and report to doctors and all those different things that are obviously part of the role of the midwife. But, you know, those real core skills that we were talking about, obviously, Elsie, when you said that you trained as a doula, that they're put to the side because there's all this bureaucratic stuff and paperwork and you know, all these tick box things that you have to do to make sure everyone's safe and inside, you know, the rules and things like that, that take you away from that woman or that birthing person. So, you know, you're relying on a piece of machinery to tell you what's going on with the contractions, you know, that kind of thing.
But you see as well, Becky, I mean, I'm kind of old fashioned in my approach because I like to do blood pressure using the aneroid thing. I don't like the, because it gives me a chance to touch the woman, to feel her pulse, to make her, I mean, we begin this connection because she knows my touch. I'm not just grabbing her hand. Do you know what I'm saying? And maintaining this closeness, this nearness as we build a relationship to support her through this journey that Millie was describing.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's so important. We have sort of lost a lot of that with the, you know, machinery's been introduced to make it easier and more, you know, give you a little bit more time to do other tasks, but then it does take away that personal element, doesn't it?
It does.
And there's so much about so much of that machinery isn't evidence-based.
Yes.
So who is it actually serving? who is it actually serving? It helps people to feel safe. It's like, it helps people who need black and white to make midwifery black and white, but midwifery isn't black and white. It's all the grey areas. And being well supported to sit in that liminal space where there are no absolutes. The only absolute is that there is someone growing a baby, birthing a baby, nursing a baby, looking, you know, and they make decisions about their life. That's the only thing that we, of which we can be sure. And even that Mother Nature's a bitch, you know, sometimes shit happens. It really does. Shit really does. There's no negligence. No one made a mistake. It just is, because sometimes it just doesn't work. And I think we've got, there's this sort of, I kind of want to use the term, this masculine paradigm of controlling and making things fit into one thing or another and trying to prevent shit from happening.
Yeah.
And we can, because we use all of our senses and all of our skills and our artistry and our knowledge and our all the evidence, which is partly our eyes and our hands and our hearts. to help those people make the right decisions for them. But that doesn't fit into that masculine paradigm because it's touchy-feely and it's the stuff that you can't measure. There are some people giving birth who need to feel viscerally safe in order to be able to do so. And there are other people who don't, and they can just go into labour, birth a baby, doesn't matter who's around, what lights are on, what's, you know, what's on the telly. And I think that's great. But for the people who need to be viscerally safe, they need safe midwives. And in the system, midwives are struggling to provide that safe care for them. So we get into this kind of cycle that the as Maddie says about too much too soon and too little too late. That we're not listening to people telling us there's something wrong, or we're saying there's something wrong when they're telling us there's something there isn't.
Absolutely. And a part of that is, you know, accentuated by the blame culture, and that's sort of what you touched on that, Millie, by saying, you know, if something goes wrong, someone has to be to blame. It's never, oh, it just happened. That everyone's always trying to find blame with somebody, isn't there?
And I think that's, for me, that's one of the fundamental issues with the system as it currently is. That the system is set up that when things happen that leave lifelong care needs, there is blame, there's a court case, and the NHS actually pays out loads without there being a court case. They just go, doesn't matter, we don't know, probably wasn't anybody's fault, might have been someone's, you know, lots and lots of cases of hypoxic insults happen before labour. They're just
You know, Millie, honestly, you see, I went to a conference with AFMA some years ago, and that was a topic of conversation. I think a lot of people don't realize the antenatal insults are more than the intrapartum insults.
Absolutely.
But it is the intrapartum insults that everybody focuses on, and then that has just completely skewed the whole management system in terms of giving compensation and so on, and annihilating midwives and others in the process. It's ridiculous.
There's no compassion.
Could you just explain what you were saying there in terms of insults? Because as someone that's a layperson, that's not a midwife, I don't understand what that means.
Go for it, Millie.
Okay. So we haven't got windows into the womb.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people get really upset about that. Occasionally, something will happen that restricts the oxygen to the fetus.
Yeah.
And if that happens for long enough, it can actually impact the development of the brain and the body. So this is one of the things that, so you have various outcomes from that, but cerebral palsy can be one of them. And there are other ways that people are impacted because they have been starved of oxygen at some point. And they often have lifelong needs that cost a lot of money. And this is the thing that breaks my heart about the society that we live in, is that there has to be somebody to blame in order to look after these people.
Yeah.
Surely in a compassionate society, we'd just go, yes, let's help. Let's support people. Let's do the best we can to help them. But no, in our society, it's got to be somebody, it was somebody's fault, and somebody's got to pay for it. And this is what's crippling a different way of the NHS's machine. But these payouts, in order to provide that compassionate care, are done through a system of blame. Even when there is no negligence, so no negligence has been proved, nobody did anything wrong, somebody still has lifelong care needs, the NHS pays out.
Yeah.
And that increases their insurance premiums. Maternity has the biggest payouts because
I can imagine
shit happening. And this is having a knock-on effect into midwifery outside, a massive knock-on effect into midwifery outside of the NHS, because those of us working outside the NHS are classed in the same risk bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the cases against independent midwives have been very few and very tiny. And it's because it's such a different animal. The continuity, the relationship is so different.
Mm-hmm.
It does provide, and we know the advantages of continuity, and we understand that this is not something that many midwives are able to commit to. And this brings me to another point, really, that forcing midwives to work in continuity models where they do not have autonomy over their caseload, they don't have autonomy over their diaries, is absolutely on a hiding to nothing. It's just harming. It's harming midwives and it's harming their clients. It has to be something that midwives can work with to work with their lives. And it has to be recognised that every now and then they're going to need a break because it's really intense.
Absolutely. And that's definitely something that's been a bit of a bone of contention within the group. We've seen that since we started the March with Midwives campaign, is that continuity of care comes up a lot. Some people are definitely, it's going to work. This is good. This needs to be part of the system, which I believe it does. But then there's the group of people that I think, you were talking about there, Millie, in that where it hasn't been rolled out correctly. It's not being supported properly. Mm-hmm. So in effect, it's not working for midwives.
Midwives want to work on labour ward. They want. Yeah. That's what they want to do. They don't want.
You'll always need labor.
So it's just this creativity and this compassion. Like, I so often, like I've been in MSLCs and MVPs now for 10 years, something like that. So originally,
gosh, you deserve a medal.
And as a, you know, as a service user rep, as a service user myself, I gave birth in the trust that I live local to 12 years ago. So I started in the MSLC when she was little and I was still breastfeeding, and then became, you know, as a breastfeeding peer supporter, and then I became a doula. And there have been some small positive changes within this trust, and it's been hard work and it's been amazing. But I always encourage everybody, whatever their role is, if they've got any interest in maternity services at all, to join their local MVP.
Yeah.
Because as we were saying about that voice, but oh, I've lost my track. I'm a bit distracted.
I think the MVP is another bit of a contentious issue, and it's definitely been mentioned a few times in the group. And, you know, they are ultimately there to provide that voice from the service user to the trust, to work between the two, to try and make things better and improve, you know, the service user's experience, aren't they?
And where I am, the continuity of care has been rolled out, I think, really well. And when it was first started, they were really much lower levels of sickness and absence in the staff teams, and it worked really well. And COVID has made that worse.
Yeah.
The pressures from that, the staffing pressures and the just, but this is one of the things that really annoys me about continuity of care, is there are places where it's being done really well, but everywhere seems to be reinventing the wheel. They're not consulting with each other. There's like this, well, we're doing it like this here. And it's like, but look, they're doing it there and they've got, it's working there. Oh, no, we're going to do it like this here. And it's just a little bit.
They do seem to tend to sort of sit within themselves, don't they? I mean, locally here, during the pandemic, the home birth services at both our trusts closed for a period of time. But on both neighbouring counties, they kept their home birth service open. Yeah. Open. So I was talking to both our local trust, saying, well, have you not spoken to Bedfordshire and Leicestershire, because they've kept their home birth service running? Could you not talk to them and find out how they're doing it, and see if, you know, you can apply some of those things here to help the people in the county that want to home birth during the pandemic? And they just seem very blinkered from what all the other trusts around them are doing.
I think sometimes, though, people are very nervous of innovation in the NHS. That is my experience. And they, if you have an inexperienced head of midwifery, director of midwifery services, it's really difficult for them to actually get their heads around the pandemic and the innovation that is required to keep the thing running. Some of them are very new to the role, and I kind of get it, right? but to go back to continuity of care in terms of rolling out, I've worked different models of continuity. I couldn't work continuity when I had young children. In fact, I would refuse to work anything that didn't match my family's needs, because those were really important at the time. So there are midwives out there who at some point in their career would be interested. Some would never be interested. But then also there were different models that I've experienced. So for example, the person I work with now very closely, she was my manager in the NHS, and she led a team that provided a good degree of continuity within the hospital service. They had core midwives for labor ward, but then midwives who rotated according to the caseloads that were being carried according to the team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then we had community teams which were doing the same things. Both of those were evaluated, and the women in the main appeared to like and appreciate that. And then the people who love labor ward, as Millie was saying, there are people who want to work on labor ward. They had the chance to choose. But now it seems that people have to just do whatever the computer says. You know, you got to work whatever 12-hour shifts. And do you know what I mean? The whole thing is completely, we have lost the autonomy, except for people who are working in places where the management and the leadership, I mean, I think leadership is crucial. You know, there are problems. The whole system needs, I mean, I don't know quite how it's going to be resolved, but there are models out there that we can work, and we don't have to work continuity of care. If you know, if we can work it, but we don't have to do it.
There are so many issues that need addressing. That's definitely something we all came up against when, as a steering group, we were talking about our manifesto and what needs to be included, because the list was incredibly long. I don't know about you, but I think our manifesto really sums up a lot of the main issues. And, you know, obviously we talked about in the last podcast, and we it's all over our social media what those main points are. And the point is with the campaign is that these are things that need to happen immediately for any of those things afterwards to work. So, you know, that I think that's the message that we want to give over with the March with Midwives campaign is this: it's in crisis at the moment. We need to do these things immediately, or nothing else is going to really work after that. I just want to, before we start running out of time tonight, I wanted to just touch on the fact that there are a lot of midwives and people working in maternity that are incredibly scared and wary of attending the vigils. Marilla, if I could ask you, obviously as a fairly new midwife, do you feel scared about attending a local vigil to you know, support the campaign?
I'm probably going to be an outlier for this one, so maybe not the best to ask. I mean, you know, I'm on the steering group of the Association of Radical Midwives. I'm not, I am not, because the caveat that all of the unions have given is work within the code. Don't bring the profession into disrepute, and that's just common sense. Everything that is in the code about it is just common sense. I'm not going there to smash anything. I'm going there to be in a vigil and stand in solidarity with the mamas and the parents and the midwives. I am a professional. I am an autonomous practitioner. I have rights, and I am exercising those rights by going and standing with these people and celebrating midwifery, but also fighting for it. So I'm not scared. And I'm talking the sparks, I think that Elsie was talking about, those sparks, those midwifery sparks, midwife sparks that are loving their jobs and able to do everything and managing and are still passionate about it. They're the ones that feel the same way as me, it seems. It's the ones that have been there for a little bit longer and have been run down a little bit. They're a bit more worried, but they're the ones that I think we're trying to get, and it is working. The more people join this movement, the more people are talking about it, the more flyers are going around, the more it seems that they're like, okay, I can dip my toe back into that revolutionary water. And it's amazing to see.
Oh, thank you. No, I think you just hit the nail on the head there, really. And I knew I was asking the right person when I asked that question, because that was the response I wanted. To, you know, student midwives out there, brand new midwives that are still, you know, dipping their toe in the water and sort of finding their feet in the profession and maybe not feeling as confident as, you know, those of you that have been in the profession for a long time. So I think it's really good to hear from somebody who is fairly fresh into midwifery to you know, hear that stance and that they're not alone and that they will be supported at the vigils, and that it's really important that their voices are heard. So I'm going to close the podcast up now, but I'd like to come to Millie and Elsie just to get maybe some last comments on about the campaign, a message to those people that are listening right now. Millie, do you want to go first?
Well, I mean, what Marilla said nearly had me in tears, but I am a fragile soul at the moment. But just to the midwives who are struggling because their instant reaction is, I'm not allowed.
Yeah.
I just want to send love and solidarity to them. And if they feel unable to come, that's okay.
Yeah.
We will still love you.
Yeah.
We still want the best for you.
Yeah. Oh, those eyes, don't let those eyes start leaking, please.
Oh, hugs.
Oh, Millie, big love to you. Just listening to you three here, and obviously, you know, we've been speaking in messaging about, you know, about the campaign for a long time, but what's 100% clear is that you are all so passionate about what you do and about the people you support. And, you know, that comes through in the way you talk about what you do. And I just like to say, as a doula, and as I hope, you know, I consider you all my friends working so closely on this campaign, is that, you know, I'm in utter awe of you as midwives for A, putting up with this shit for so long, for B, having that confidence to really stand up and speak for the people that you're supporting and for your fellow midwives. And I don't have a C, but just... But just, you know, big love to you all, and you know, thank you.
Yeah, thank you,
Elsie. Final words for the podcast from the legend.
Oh my word! Mm-hmm. Well, I would encourage people to come because we have the support of the Royal College of Midwives. We have the support of our regulator. We are required to raise our voices when there are issues. And we start at the level the lowest level, and we work our way up. This is entirely appropriate. So please come out. Yeah. We are the ones we have been waiting for. There is no other way.
Yeah. Oh, I think, you know, if we're starting at a low level, we've started that bar pretty high.
No, we started at the low level, in the beginning. We are now at the highest point. This, what else can we do after this? Yeah. Except the solution, really. Yeah, this is the highest point.
Thank you, Elsie. Amazing words. I am absolutely in awe of you all, and this has been an absolutely fantastic podcast to do. I'm so glad you could all be here today. Thank you for your contributions.
Well, thank you for having us.
Okay, so that's the end of the podcast for today. Thank you everyone who's listening, and hopefully see you all on the 21st of November at the vigils. You know, obviously share, follow the social media and do what you can, be there if you can, and support the cause, because we're going to be marching with midwives, all of us. Until next time, bye. I really hope you enjoyed this special March with Midwives episode. Sam and I will be back really soon with some more birth activist podcast episodes. Bye for now.